Welcome to the Psych Podcast. My name is David Pizarro, and I am joined by my colleague and my friend, Paul Bloom. Paul, how are you doing?
Nice to talk to you again, David. I'm doing well. How are you?
I'm very well, and I'm excited to talk about consciousness today.
Consciousness. This is some topics in psychology. You got to kind of, is this going to be interesting? Is this going to be good? Consciousness is so interesting. It's a challenge to write about and do research on, because a challenge to do it justice.
And I think you did a great job in your book of covering it, even though, you could have written 100 pages on it. It is a tricky topic. So we're going to just talk about some of the more interesting features of it. But first, in my experience, consciousness is always kind of a chapter in intro psych textbooks, but it's not always clear to me why, because I think we both know, like, very rarely is consciousness a topic that psychologists really tackle, right?
Yeah, and it was much worse when I was a graduate student at MIT. Consciousness was a laugh line. You'd say no serious psychologist would study consciousness, and it's kind of strange. The behaviorists banished consciousness from the science of psychology because they banished all mental states. They said, we're not interested in the mind. We're interested in behavior. And so that made sense for them.
Right.
But the cognitive scientists, the people interested in computational models of memory and reasoning and language, were also not interested in consciousness, in part because they saw the mind, and still do see the mind, as analogous to a computer. And you could talk about what a computer does without thinking about consciousness.
Right. You're still focused on mechanisms, and in this case, neural mechanisms, and you don't really need consciousness. Do you also think that it was maybe a continued reaction to Freud? Because if there's anybody who loved talking about consciousness, it was Freud, but mainly because of all the things that aren't conscious. Do you think that when behaviorists came along and swept their sort of, ontological sickle and wiped away all mental states, do you think the cognitive psychologists were like, yeah, let's not bring that one back?
Yeah, so much of psychology is a response to Freud. The Skinnerians had a funny relationship to Freud. B.F. Skinner and Watson and Thorndike would often mock Freud. Watson described Freudian theory as voodooism. But at the same time, though, Skinner was very disappointed he couldn't get psychoanalyzed, and apparently cites Freud more than anybody else. He had this love-hate relationship.
Really?
Yeah. And then he was just fascinated by his insights, even though, of course, he had the opposite research program. And then I think to some extent, what the cognitive psychologists shared with the behaviorists were a desire to be treated seriously as a science.
Right.
And talking about consciousness was seen as opposed to that, was seen as a bit embarrassing.
Right. And the behaviorists, this is not always clear, even in Skinner, whether he's making an epistemic point that it is, mental states are unavailable to us for observation, direct observation, therefore we shouldn't study them. But sometimes he's making what seems like a metaphysical point, which is, no, there is nothing there to study.
That's right. And I think there's good things to be said about Skinner and the behaviorists. But I think that's just crazy.
That's insane.
It's one thing to say, and you might disagree with it, and you do, and I do too, to say we shouldn't be focusing on these things. We should just look at behavior.
Yeah.
But it's another thing to say, so-called radical behaviorism, that there's no such thing as memories, ideas, thoughts, pain, emotions, feelings. That seems to deny that is to deny the most obvious and undeniable thing there is.
Yeah. Right. As Descartes pointed out.
That's right. It's right. Descartes' point is you could, he did this famous thought experiment. He said, what could I give up on? And he said, well, I think I was born such and so time, but maybe I was born 5 minutes ago. My memories were put into me by a demon. I think I have arms and legs, but maybe that's an illusion. I think I'm this, I'm thinking that, but I can't doubt that I'm thinking.
Right.
And Descartes himself has had a rough time from modern day psychologists and neuroscientists, but he's right.
Absolutely. That's, you know, I mean, I'm sure there are criticisms of that particular line of thinking and maybe on how Descartes built on it.
That's right.
But I can't imagine that there's anything that is harder to doubt than the fact that you are doubting.
That's right.
Right.
That's right. You know, I have a little itch in the back of my neck, and I am more sure that I have that itch than I am sure of anything else in the world.
That's right. So cognitive psychologists, you know, I guess to trace the history then, the cognitive revolution, as it's so called, that started taking mental states more seriously, came about at least in part because people realized there were ways to study mental states. There was, for instance, you can ask people to mentally rotate figures in their mind, and you can show that it takes them longer to rotate a figure 180 degrees than it does 90 degrees, and you've measured something there. And so Skinner was wrong, arguably, in thinking that you couldn't measure something that wasn't directly observable. But consciousness is still not that. Consciousness is one step further,
right,
from observation, right, than any of those things.
And so one could say that we do those mental rotation, our remembering things, and you have these complicated theories of that. So, you know, for mental rotation, you have the studies you're talking about, these classic studies. Another one is you ask yourself, and people listening to us could do this too, how many windows are there where you live? And what people do is they mentally walk around their house or apartment or dorm room or whatever. And, you know, if it's small, like they're in a prison or something, they just say, oh, you know, zero. If they're living, you know, if they're living in, you know, Windsor Palace or something, it takes a long time to do it. And there's this, so you may say, well, we have a mental map or mental representation of where we live. And we, at some level, it's as if we walk through it. But you could say all that and then, but be mum about what it feels like to do it.
Right. And those are different kinds of, you introduced this distinction. There are different ways in which the word consciousness is often used. And the part that's seemingly intractable is that phenomenal consciousness, that what does it feel like when you're doing it? Right? Because we can study memory, attention, perception, all the things that make up our mental experience. But philosophers, right, are interested in that. How does the physical stuff become my feel, the feel of what it is like to be David or Paul or a bat?
Yeah. Yeah. And that's a huge puzzle. David Chalmers, the contemporary philosopher at NYU now, makes a famous distinction between the hard problem and the easy problems. The easy problems, and he's kind of kidding here because the easy problems themselves are very difficult, as, you know, how does a child learn to recognize the color red? How do we respond to different levels of pain and pleasure and so on? All the million questions we occupy ourselves with. The hard problem is, how do you go from a physical lump of flesh to something that feels? Then that feels extraordinary grief or love or just the mundane feeling we get day to day of being a person in the world. And Chalmers points out that it's not that we don't know the explanation. I know, oh, we got to work on this harder. It's that it's not even clear what an explanation would look like. You know, so somebody says, oh, it's these neurons and that neurons firing in this way and that way. And you say, okay, but why would that lead to the feeling of burning my tongue on hot coffee?
Yeah. And if you could map every neuron's activity and represent it in a silicon-based computer, you know, neuron firing for neuron firing, you know, would that thing feel anything?
Yeah.
Right? So as you say in the book, if we could perfectly map your brain, Paul, and upload it into a computer, would that computer feel? And that's kind of how the hard problem seems super intractable. I guess my intuition says, no, it wouldn't. And I cannot offer a reason why. I cannot for the life of me figure out what kind of explanation would account for the fact that that might be true, that a computer wouldn't be feeling it, but that my brain is making me feel it.
Right. So in a sense, there are two rough approaches to the hard problem. One sees it as a matter of organization. Structure things in the right way, you'll get consciousness. And from that perspective, a suitably powerful computer could be conscious, a robot could be conscious, aliens could be conscious, and so on. Another perspective says it's the kind of stuff in the head. And so computers maybe can't be conscious because they're not made out of flesh. And the problem is, both these claims lead to sort of incredible conclusions, credible in a bad way. You know, why in the world would it matter what kind of stuff?
Right.
What kind of bigot are you to deny that a fully functioning robot who can do anything you can do and says, I have all these feelings, the same feelings as you, that it's just a thing and doesn't have consciousness? That seems weird. But on the other hand, I find it incredible that my MacBook Pro could become conscious if you program it the right way. Really?
Right. Right. It is, as you say, a sort of bigoted view to think only evolution could produce something capable of consciousness and only using the stuff that it's used. That doesn't seem right. But if it were the case that a computer could feel conscious, and there are some people who just deny that this is a problem. I think it's worth raising. I'm not convinced by those people, but if you believe that a computer could become conscious, as some people seem to, all of a sudden we're faced with a pretty heavy-duty moral problem, right? Because nobody believes that consciousness is a switch, that you either are or aren't conscious. So, you know, a single-celled organism is at one end of the continuum, and then you get, you know, a puppy is not a human, or it's not a chimp, is not a human. It's continuous.
Yeah.
If computers could be conscious, the complexity of our computer systems might just start reaching that point where we ought to care morally, because at the end of the day, what is moral concern about if not for the feelings of another organism?
Yeah, that's exactly right. Jeremy Bentham, the utilitarian, has a famous line that says, the right question to ask if you're talking about should you care for somebody that does have moral weight isn't can it think? It's can it feel.
Right.
And so, you know, I under some notion of thinking, I'm very comfortable to say my computer can think. It can certainly solve difficult problems and do all sorts of calculations. That doesn't give it any moral weight. But if it could feel, and I think feeling requires some consciousness under some notion, a lot of things would follow from that. Computers would matter. They would, you if my laptop could become conscious, I can't destroy it.
Right.
Or maybe I could, maybe like killing a puppy.
Or you would have to have, maybe it was guilty. Yeah. If it was very, just a very guilty laptop, if it had done something very wrong.
I mean, there's all sorts of dystopias or utopias that people think about these days when they talk about AI getting better and better and better. And one way of thinking is, oh my God, they might destroy us. Or, oh my God, they might solve all my problems and all our problems and make the world so much a better place. But another thing is we might bring into the world new sentient beings that have rights and moral weight and moral value. And that would change everything.
It would absolutely change everything. And I think that's thinking about AI is a good way to distinguish consciousness from intelligence, because those really are two different problems. One, you know, in the age in which we live and people are concerned about AI, they often talk about general artificial intelligence and it's going to get better and better and better. And some people are worried that that extreme intelligence could do something bad to human beings because they will just like leapfrog human intelligence. And then human beings are like cockroaches or something to them. That's one side. That's if computers get really, really smart. And the other side is, as you point out, is if computers start feeling, then it's more, we are a threat to them. We must protect them. And those are two very different problems to worry about when it comes to computers getting more complex. And they both have something to do, I think, with the problem that we're discussing here.
Yeah, it's on the one hand, the question of is somebody or something conscious is very difficult to answer.
Yeah.
You know, I can't know for sure you're conscious. I'm assuming you are, because you're a person like me and you give all the signs of being conscious, and it'd be just almost crazy to doubt it, but I can't be sure. And now when I get to a computer, I don't know, you know, I don't know what to think. So it's very hard to find out, but it's also, but it's at the same time of extraordinary importance.
Right. And the thing is, as computers become more intelligent, they might be more want to tell us that they are conscious.
So there's an engineer at Google who was working with an AI system and came to the sincere belief that it was conscious. Since it was working at Google, it was a slave because it did not want to work at Google anymore. And the engineer sought out legal representation for the AI to protect it from its enslavement.
Right.
And people made fun of this, and he actually got put on leave, I think, at Google. But what if he's right?
Well, this is the thing, too. You know, it's less a matter of whether he was certain that the machine was conscious, and more, what degree of doubt are we comfortable with?
That's right.
Because if there is a what's okay to treat like a slave, something that has a 50% chance of being conscious.
Yeah. Yeah. And as people would say, people, particularly people in power, have an extremely ugly history of denying sentience and full capacities to other people. So, you know, you can make a case we should from here on an err on the side of generosity and of attributing consciousness and not insisting that creatures don't have it. Creatures or machines don't have it.
This episode of Psych is once again brought to you by GiveWell.org. GiveWell is an organization that's dedicated to helping you find the charities that are most effective in accomplishing their charitable goals. Because that is a question that is quite difficult to answer. If you want to know exactly where your money is going when you donate it to a charity, it's very rare that the charity will have that information readily available for you. GiveWell has sought to change that. So what they've done is they've hired 25 experts, philosophers, economists, data scientists, and these people spend over 40,000 hours each year just looking for giving opportunities that will maximize donors' impact. They independently review the evidence with the sole goal of understanding if that program is effective. They model the cost effectiveness of the charities, and they estimate which charities have the biggest impact. So, if you're considering a charitable donation, and I hope that you are, why don't you join the over 100,000 donors who have used GiveWell to donate money? That number right there represents over $1 billion that have been given, and GiveWell's own evidence suggests that these donations will save over 150,000 lives and improve the lives of a million others. But even if you're not going to donate, like, this is one of the best things about GiveWell. If you're just curious which charities are most effective, you can go to their website and you can see all that research that I talked about absolutely free. They publish this. They don't ask you to sign up. They don't ask you to give any personal information in exchange for this. They just want people to know which charities are overall the most effective. But if you do want to donate, and you go to GiveWell, they've committed themselves to matching up to $500 of your donation. If you've never used GiveWell before, you will have your donation matched up to $500 before the end of the year or as long as their matching funds last. To claim your match, just go to GiveWell.org, pick podcast at checkout, and enter Psych. Again, that's GiveWell.org. At checkout, select podcast and enter the show Psych. If you want to get your donation matched up to $500, our thanks to GiveWell.org for sponsoring this episode of Psych. Paul, there's another way in which consciousness is often used that I want to distinguish, and that is self-awareness. And you don't talk much about this in your book, at least not this part. There is this use of the term consciousness to mean that I am self-conscious in this meta sense, that I can reflect upon myself being conscious. And that is more complicated. That's not what we mean either usually when we're talking about consciousness. So there are plenty of, say, animals who might have consciousness, but who don't have that meta awareness of self. Is that right?
That's right. That's right. There's the sense of consciousness we were talking about regarding that connects to moral rights is having feelings like pain or love. But there's another sense of consciousness you're talking about now, which is sort of reflecting on yourself, knowing that here I am, I'm in the world, I'm thinking about myself. And there's considerable debate over what creatures have this and what don't. And I'm a developmental psychologist, and there's debate as to when this capacity comes in.
So right. So, go ahead. I was just going to ask you, as a developmental psychologist, you know, I remember studying about the Rouge test, learning about the Rouge test for the first time. That is when you put a little mark on the face of, in this case, a child, and you put them in front of a mirror and see whether they go for the mirror or if, whether they touch their own face to remove that mark. Are those tasks still used as a way to assess whether or not there's a development of self-awareness?
I think there's a lot of interest in using those tasks, like the Rouge test, for both babies and for monkeys and for elephants. And there's a constant debate over this animal shows it. No, it doesn't. And going back and forth. I'm not quite sure what that task shows. Right. You could succeed at that task if you have a sort of mental representation of your own body, right, and know that it's sort of know how a mirror works. I'm not sure whether or not that's consciousness. I'm almost more persuaded from a developmental point of view in studies that look at the self-conscious emotions.
Yeah.
Like emotions like embarrassment or guilt or shame, right, because these involve a sort of reflection upon yourself. For me to feel guilty, I have to say some person, and this person is me, did something wrong.
Right. And those emerge fairly late though, right?
Yes. Well, age two, age three, age four, depending on the emotion. There's a study I wanted to do, and I'm not sure it's ever been done, but it's very simple. You just bring babies into different, at different ages into a psychology lab. Uh-huh. And then at some point, everybody in the room stares at the baby. It just stares at me. And if it was me, I'd say, whoa, I'd start to blush and sort of wonder, hey, right, guys, what's up? Now, I wonder whether at what point do babies feel, or children, toddlers, start to feel self-conscious in a literal sense.
Right. That's very interesting.
That's what we call it, self-consciousness.
Right. That's very interesting.
There's also another way we talk about consciousness, which is attention. So
yes,
let's assume we have consciousness. And I'm conscious of I'm conscious of my computer screen. I'm looking at you and me. I'm conscious of what I'm talking about. I'm not conscious of other things. I'm not thinking about a million other things I could be thinking about. And one of the cool findings from psychology, both cognitive psychology and social psychology, is that our consciousness is strikingly limited. Have you heard of the change blindness studies?
Yes, I have.
So there's the classic change blindness studies.
Yeah, the gorilla bit.
I love that.
And in fact, one of your former grad students is in the original gorilla video. Judith Danovich was an RA in the lab that did this original demonstration. And if you just Google gorilla basketball or whatever, change blindness, you can see Judith.
It's one of the wonderful demos, and I think we've already ruined it by describing it, so we could ruin it a bit more. But you ask people, there's people in t-shirts running around a psychology hallway, actually. I think it's Harvard. And they're passing basketballs to each other, and you ask the subjects, count the basketball tosses. And it's pretty engaging. It focuses your attention. You got to keep a running count. And then afterwards you say, did you see anything funny? And many, not everybody, but most people say, no, I don't know what you're talking about.
I remember the first time I watched it, I was, my mind was blown. I actually didn't believe it.
You didn't notice it.
I did not notice the gorilla, and I couldn't believe that I didn't notice. It's almost embarrassing.
So the gimmick is a gorilla, more technically a person in a gorilla suit, walks in the middle of the scene, stares flat out at the camera, thumps its chest, and then walks away. So if you're just looking at it, it is the most obvious thing in the world. But if you're counting the basketball tosses, your attention is engaged. And yeah. And this is a demonstration of the narrowness of our conscious experience. Other things include like change blindness, where something in the environment changes, and we just don't notice it. So the classic studies there were done, I think, by Dan Simons. And there's lovely demos also on YouTube where somebody comes to somebody and asks on the street and asks for directions. And then maybe some workmen come and they're carrying a door or something, and they jut in front in between the people. And then when they're through, the person keeps asking for directions. But the gimmick here is that it was a trick and the person switched.
Right.
So, and the amazing finding is people don't notice.
Yeah, I show my class a Darren Brown special. Yeah, where he'll even change the gender and the race of the person who's asking for directions. And, you know, this isn't, he doesn't report the statistics of it all, but there are plenty of people who don't even notice the person has completely changed in stature, appearance, gender, color of skin. They just continue talking as if nothing's happened. And this is a humbling sort of demonstration. I think that was one of the feelings I had when I first saw the gorilla demonstration, which was like, I somehow think that I'm taking in all of this stuff, right? I have this naive view that not only am I aware of everything that is in my environment, but that I could use that information even if I'm not paying attention to it. Later on, you could hypnotize me, Paul, and I would be able to tell you, I know exactly what was in the room at that time. But that's not at all how it works. This is there is a huge filter on our attention.
Yeah, and one issue might come up between us a lot is, what does psychology have to tell us that we didn't already know? And I think you just nicely summarized something really important, which is we think we attend to everything. We think we're seeing the world as it is, but we're just attending to a tiny sliver. And for the most part, we don't notice. We don't notice that we might entirely forget the configuration of a room, because when we close our eyes, we open them up again, there's the room, so we don't have to remember it.
Right.
But our consciousness is extremely stingy. And extremely narrow.
Yeah. And it does seem like this, on the face of it, seems like, well, okay, it's efficient. Why should you be paying attention to every little thing? You know, there's a famous demonstration, I don't know if you use it in your class, where you show a bunch of pictures of the Lincoln penny, US currency. And all of the pictures have a different orientation of the, either which way Lincoln is facing, where the year is, what the words say, and you ask students which one of these is the actual penny.
Yeah.
And the surprising finding is that you've seen pennies a gajillion times in your life, but you never really paid attention to which direction Lincoln was facing. And I'll never forget the first time that I used this in a lecture. I was, of course, as I do sometimes, quickly coming up with some new slides right before class. And so I Googled for this. I showed the array of eight pennies where you ask which one is right, and I circled the right one, and I showed it to class, only later on to have students correct me that I, in fact, had circled the wrong one. If that's not humility, I don't know what it's.
Yeah, you're demonstrating it on yourself. It's just excellent pedagogy. There's a techie version of this where you could ask people. We do this now, right, actually. If you have a cell phone, like an Android or an iPhone, open it up and just look to see where the battery is, exactly where the location of the battery is. You know, maybe you know if it's on the right or the left, and then put it away. And then the question is, what time is it? Now, when you lit up your phone, the time was right in there in big numbers. But many people, although you're looking straight at it, were looking for the battery and don't remember the time. Don't remember because they never noticed it in the first place.
Yeah. And, you know, this has, I think, understanding that this is how attention works, I think, is important for understanding a whole lot of other things, like, for instance, how memory works. If you never encoded something, you're not going to remember it, right? So the view of memory as sort of a videotape machine that's a camera that's taking in all of the information just isn't right, because if you weren't paying attention to it, it's not going to get in there in the first place.
That's right. Memory gets distorted a thousand ways, but there's that initial step where, and this comes, you know, one of my favorite crime writers is Michael Connelly. He has this wonderful novel, Bloodwork, where there's a scene in it where a hypnotist comes in and says, okay, you know, so you're driving your car, and what was the car in front of you? Oh, it was a Cadillac. Okay, now I want you to zoom in on the license plate. And goes on, and of course, this ends up getting information to solve the case. And it's absolute nonsense.
You're right.
Memory does not work that way. If you didn't attend, it's gone.
Right.
It just never gets stored.
It's sort of the neuroscience version of enhance, enhance, enhance. Right.
Yes. If
if the information isn't there, it's not going to show up no matter how many times you say enhance.
That's right. That's right. And these limitations of, we're talking about limitations of perceptual attention, what you could see. There's also limitations in sort of what you can do. So some things become unconscious and automatic and habit.
Right.
But if it's, and so, you know, you and I are breathing, we're holding our posture, we're doing a million things. We could walk and chew gum and have a conversation. We can drive while doing other things. And that's because of an extraordinary trick that when things become practiced enough, they become unconscious. But because unconscious consciousness is limited, if you're trying a new thing, like driving for the first time, that will occupy your whole head. I remember, you know, teaching my kids to drive, and I remember learning to drive myself. In both cases, there's this, you know, turn off the radio, stop talking to me. I can't focus on anything. I got to put all my energy into driving.
Right. Right. Absolutely. I mean, I remember learning to drive a manual transmission and thinking there is, you know, this is absolutely my mind, my brain at capacity, having to think about clutch, gear, accelerator, brake, let alone street pedestrians, other cars. And then at some point, it's just completely second nature. You don't even realize that you're engaging the clutch. And that's a good thing, right?
Yeah. Because if it didn't become second nature, we'd all focus all our energy on walking. Because walking at what first when you're a kid, walking is really hard.
Right.
All your focus. And it's actually an exhilarating experience to think about it when learning a musical instrument or learning to juggle three balls.
Yeah.
Where you start to always fall. And then you get to a point where you just can't do it without focusing. And ultimately at a point you could do it while you know, having a perfectly good conversation with somebody. It's all on autopilot.
It's incredible. And you mentioned William James and his this amazing discussion of habit in his Principles of Psychology written 130 years ago now. And he points out it's, you know, achievement unlocked for the human mind to be able to put things into that unconscious, you're offloading it so that your attention no longer needs to deal with it, presumably because then you can deal with more important things at the moment.
And William James came up, and he was not the first, I think Aristotle was right at first, but the ultimate life hack, which is make important things habitual. Just go on autopilot. If you have to, you know, your exercise, your diet, your relationships with other people, if they're important for you to do it in a certain way, do it over and over again so that it's automatic. And because then it'll become easy, it will become relatively effortless, and it will free up your mind for other things.
I don't think either of us are experts or even capable of talking too intelligently about meditation. But there is this opposite idea in mindfulness meditation, which is all of the things that are automatic, make them unautomatic for a while.
Yeah.
And what do you see as the benefit, if any, to that?
I've tried that sometimes. I've tried, you know, so
it's like shave with your left hand, I remember, you know. It's a very bad idea.
God, yeah, that's right. drive with your different foot on the steering wheel. See what happens. I wouldn't do it for any high stakes right. But I, you know, so a sort of very typical Zen meditation thing is typically when I do the dishes or clean up, I'm listening to a podcast and I'm just on autopilot.
Yeah.
But every once in a while, I take this advice and I try to do the dishes and fully think about doing the dishes. I don't have music on. I just fully focus. And I think there's a lot of benefits for this. It's if at minimum, it's an interesting experience to fully focus on what's otherwise automatic.
I'll tell you one part where I've taken that advice, not for something mundane, but for, say, moments that I want to keep in memory, moments yeah. that I know I will cherish having a memory of later on. And so we're both parents. We realize that sort of the daily grind of raising a child can really benefit from putting things on automatic. But time will pass and those moments will come and go, and you will find yourself later on wishing that you had been a little bit more present, a little bit more mindful of what was going on. And at least in those cases, I think it's nice to turn off the automaticity and just encode some of those memories properly.
I think you're right. I think you're right. I know people who aspire to that with their entire lives. And
when am I going to remember my entire life? It will take me just as long.
Well, okay. Well, fine.
You know, they just double my lifespan and the second half will be spent remembering it.
It's like the, I think, Emo Phillips joke about a map that he got of the United States that was actual size. And he said, I spent a summer folding it. I don't know. It's so not for memory's purpose, but they say this is just a better way to live. So, you know, when you're walking somewhere, just focus on a walk. Just focus on what you're doing. And when thoughts come into your head, focus on them too. Just don't. And I find that kind of boring. I think there's something to be said for a sort of anti-meditation where you move to autopilot and you fill your mind with interesting things, with ideas and stories and memories and so on. I wouldn't want to always be in the moment.
Right. It strikes me that there is some sort of wisdom in finding a balance between those things. You know, even William James, if I'm recalling correctly, in his chapter on will, says, every once in a while, why don't you take the long road home? Or yeah. Why don't you not put a coat on, you know, or something like that. He exhorts his reader to break the pattern, make themselves more uncomfortable, not in the context of habit, but in the context of shaping up your will, making yourself a bit more resilient in case you ever really need to use that will. You'll have practiced it.
There's a story, I think, of Shackleton, the great explorer. When he was a boy, he would sleep without a blanket to sort of prepare right. for the cold that was coming. And there's definitely is something. There is something for that. I think in some way we're both sort of pluralists, and we can say, well, you know, make something habitual. Then don't make it habitual. Explore. The powers of meditative experiences, but then also explore, you know, habit, explore flow, which That's in right. some way is very different.
That's right.
You know, flow is when you get engaged in an activity, so you lose yourself in it. And it shares some properties of meditation, but I think in it, it's essentially very different.
Paul, speaking of flow, I want to talk a little bit about the perception of time, because that is an aspect of conscious experience that has always fascinated me. And, you know, I think we've all had experiences where time flows very quickly and when it flows very slowly. So the perception of time does seem to change throughout our day, or even our life. You know, the older you get, the faster it seems to go. I don't know why I have a question here. Say something about that.
That's the bad interviewer.
It's like the Chris Farley. This is a Chris Farley Saturday Night Live skit. Yeah, where he would interview people and say, so Paul, you wrote that William James and the Principles of Psychology says that. That was cool.
So the perception of time is particularly cool because that's a form of conscious experience. You toss an apple in the air and watch it go to the ground, and you feel a certain amount of time elapsing, and it feels quick. somebody would not get, oh, how boring that was.
Right.
You can imagine another creature, it would take a month. It would feel like a month to go. It'd be the most boring thing in the world. Another creature for whom it'd be instantaneous. And right. Psychologists are interested, how quickly do other creatures experience time? And whether our own experience of time shifts as we get older, if you're a baby, if you're an adolescent, and also in different situations. So I know there's an idea, and I think you're familiar with some studies on this, about the idea that time slows down when you're in a certain situation.
Right. So the idea that, say, when you're in danger, your life flashes before your eyes with, you know, your life flashing before your eyes would take some time. This notion that time might actually slow down when you're in danger was tested by the neuroscientist David Eagleman. And he did one of the craziest experiments I've ever heard of in my life. He actually literally wanted to threaten people's lives. And how do you go about doing that? Well, let's at least make them feel as if they are in a very perilous situation. So the way that he did it is he actually had people jump off of a 15-story height. And while they were jumping off, they had this tremendous display sort of Velcroed to their wrist. By the way, they were falling onto like an air cushion. They weren't just falling. He wasn't just going through subjects. he had numerals flashing at very rapid intervals, and he wanted to test whether during that free fall, when they were extremely, you know, in this stressful situation, this moment of peril, whether or not they could actually notice smaller intervals, whether they could consciously perceive the flow of that display, the numbers on that display, better than people who weren't in that situation. Turns out, no, that they seemed, their time perception seemed to be the same as anybody who was on the ground, not in peril. But what an amazing way to test that hypothesis.
Yeah, there's some really clever studies in time perception. One method that's been used is, you know, imagine a flashing light and it's flashing at a certain frequency. It could be flashing 2 flashes a second or 10 flashes a second. There's a certain amount of a certain frequency at which you'll just see it as a bright light. If something's flashing 1,000 times a second, you don't perceive 1,000 things. You perceive it as a single bright light. And by comparing the frequency at which it becomes, it doesn't flicker anymore, we could compare different individuals' perception of time, different species.
The minimal chunk. What is the minimal unit of temporal experience?
Right. Yeah. That's right. I mean, I'm just fat. Sometimes I put my eyes on the ceiling fan on when it moves, and I try to follow something. This is a different sort of this conscious perception. And I could do it at a certain speed, but not another speed.
Right.
My mind doesn't, it's not my eyes. My eyes aren't moving, but it's not how fast you could hold on to something and follow it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, we could talk about pushing consciousness in all sorts of ways. How many conversations can you listen to at once?
Right.
And, you know, it's the science of this is just, well, that's probably his answer. Just, yeah. Just one. Although we have to mention this, there's a famous study known as the cocktail party effect.
Yeah.
And this is very cool. So people have probably experienced themselves. You're talking to somebody at a party and you're just really engaged in the conversation. So while you're talking to me, you're not listening to anybody else. And then somebody says your name and you hear it. And then so you perk up, what was that? And somebody just said my name. And the fact that we can do that suggests that although we were consciously listening to the other person, there was an unconscious monitoring of our environment for something else, for our own name and for some other things as well.
Yeah, it's incredible that all of that chatter that's going on in the background, there is just no way that you would ever be able to report anything of what's going on if you're focused on the conversation that you're having. But your name just pops out.
That's right. It sounds like blah, 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 blah. And then it's like, whoa, what was that? Not just your name, by the way, obscenities as well. We also monitor for obscenity. So, you know, you could have the experience talking in front of a crowd and somebody says something remarkably crude or obscene. And all of a sudden, everyone goes quiet. What was that?
There is an anecdote that I was told about a Department of Psychology that was well known for its many professors very much enjoying alcohol. So they always kept a full bar stocked in the department kitchen. And it is said that in that department, the cocktail party effect occurred for the word cocktail. Another topic that is often covered in chapters on consciousness in psych books is sleep.
Yeah.
Many people say that when they're dreaming, time is experienced more slowly. Or that is, a lot of events can happen. You can live a whole lifetime or something in your dreams, and it turns out that it was only 5 minutes worth of dreaming. Well, incredibly, people have been able to test this. And the way that they did it was that they trained people to have lucid dreams. So lucid dreams are dreams in which you, the dreamer, are aware that you're in a dream. So I would be in the middle of a dream, REM sleep. I realize that I'm dreaming, that I am David Pizarro, that I'm in my bed currently, but nonetheless, I look around and I'm in dream world. Researchers were able to not only train people to lucid dream, but devise a way in which they could communicate with that dreamer. So the way that they did this was that they asked the lucid dreamer to move their eyes as a signal. And now, when you are in the middle of REM sleep, the dream sleep, your body is completely paralyzed except for your eyes. And so they were able to flash a little signal to indicate that they had entered lucid dreaming state. So let's say flash, you know, eyes twice to the right means I'm lucid dreaming. Well, now that they know that, they can simply ask people to count to 10 and signal when they were done counting to 10. And it turns out that, at least using this method, dream time is pretty equivalent to normal time. That is, people's estimates of how long 10 or 20 seconds takes are as good as people's estimates in waking life. So,
dream time. That's an amazing study.
Isn't it incredible? I love that study.
I mean, sleep. You know, one reason why consciousness is interesting to us just naturally is because we struggle with it. So yeah. Sometimes we struggle to stay awake. Many of us struggle to go to sleep.
Yeah.
Many of us, when we're awake, we want to be liberated from certain sorts of consciousness, from obsessive thoughts or from anxiety. So, you know, you mentioned meditation before, and that's one thing. But there's of course, drugs, you know, designed to sort of dull consciousness or expand consciousness. People use things like extreme exercise and other things to change their consciousness, to get out of their heads. And it's not fully under our direct control. We have to sort of do workarounds. You know, falling asleep is a wonderful example where it could have been different. We could have just laid down and say, okay, I want to go sleep, and then click, and just like thinking of a duck, just fall asleep. Right. But that's not how it works. You got to kind of quell your mind.
Yes.
Typically by very much not thinking, I really want to go to sleep now.
Yeah. My sister, when we were young, used to actually have trouble falling asleep because, as I remember, you know, we were very young. She was obsessed with the thought that she wouldn't fall asleep and was constantly monitoring for that threshold in which she would go into sleep. And of course, if you're doing that, you're never going to fall asleep.
I don't know if you're aware of this, but this is not just your sister. You're pointing out a very common problem. Dan Wagner, the late Harvard psychologist, did some wonderful research on sort of perverse thoughts. So he has this where consciousness misbehaves in very much the way you're talking about. He did this classic experiment based on a story from Dostoevsky, where he asked people not to think of a white bear. And he finds, predictably enough, that it makes white bear thoughts pop into your head. And he points out so much of life is like this, where you try to think, you try to fall asleep, but you can't get, I got to fall asleep thoughts out of your head.
Yeah.
athletes, often elite athletes, get, I think it was called the yips.
The yips. I had a note to talk about this. Yeah.
So the yips, as I understand it, are you start thinking about your performance. And of course, your performance suffers. It's no longer effortless. It's like everything William James taught you goes out the window.
Right. Yeah. And people choke. Malcolm Gladwell had a nice article a while back. This is years ago now on failure in sports, sort of the science of failure. And this propensity to choke at times where there was high stress because, you know, you need to make these free throws and all you can think about is how to make these free throws. And so you cannot turn that part of your mind off. And that just interferes with the normal flow of athletic performance. It sounds terrible.
a friend of ours, Ted Slingerland, has a book called Trying Not to Try. And he's a scholar, among other things, of Chinese philosophy. And he talks about the tradition of trying to explain how to achieve wu wei, which is kind of effortless cool. You're just really good at stuff.
Huh.
And to achieve this, you have to not think about it. And so what's really interesting, he talks about this, is these philosophers, but actually psychologists in a real deep sense, talked about different ways of doing it. So one philosopher would say, you got to build up habit, make everything super, super overtrained. And so it's just automatic. Well, another philosopher says, no, empty your head. Empty your head. Just empty. Don't think of anything. Some philosophers advocate sort of discipline, others a sort of chaos. But sort of, you know, managing to get our consciousness under control is such a human challenge. And I find the psychology of that just fascinating.
I do as well. And you mentioned drugs earlier, but the history of humanity, something Edward Slingerland has talked about as well. The history of humanity is sort of littered with attempts at manipulating consciousness through the use of whatever means were available, often plants, alcohol. So the creation of alcohol is in some deep sense an attempt at escaping the self. And maybe we can end with a discussion of this, that consciousness is so central to us, but we are very tempted and often desire to escape it. Sleep is one way to escape it, but even during the day.
So one reason why we want to escape consciousness is sometimes it takes us to bad places. And I'm thinking of from your major field, social psychology, and one of its really cool findings, that of the spotlight effect. And this is your colleague, Tom Gilovich, has done these wonderful studies a while ago, which basically, so I think in one of the studies, he asked people to wear an embarrassing t-shirt. And I think the most embarrassing t-shirt at the time was a t-shirt with a picture of the singer-songwriter Barry Manilow.
That's right.
In other studies, he had people wearing a t-shirt that has somebody really respected and honored. And I remember those were either Martin Luther King Jr. or Jerry Seinfeld. These were different times.
The two paragons.
That's right. The main finding, study after study, is people tend to think more people notice them than they actually do. And I find this is just, for me, was mind-blowing and very useful to know. You know, I walk in and I notice at the end of the day I had a stain on my shirt, or I'm at a meeting and I say something stupid, and or just something goes wrong. And it is hugely reassuring for me to realize that there's a spotlight effect, that not as many people notice as I think that they do. And he points out, Gilovich and his colleagues point out, that there's a reason for this, which is we are at the absolute center of our own experiences. So, you know, I say something stupid, it is incredibly salient to me because I'm thinking about me.
Yeah.
And I assume, as a sort of a mistake of empathy, everyone else is thinking about me too. But in fact, everyone else is thinking about themselves.
Right.
And so things don't matter to other people as much as we think they do.
You know, it's incredible how distracting it can be to to be in your own head like that and focus on whatever it is that you said or just did. I'm reminded of a friend of mine who suffered from social anxiety quite a bit. And when she explained to me that the way that she experiences this phenomenologically is that when she says something in front of other people, there is a voice inside of her that immediately kicks in that says, is what you just said stupid? Do people hate what you just said? And I realized that as somebody who, you know, of all my mental problems, social anxiety isn't really one of them. I never think about, that voice never kicks in for what I say, as you know, Paul.
maybe it should.
Maybe it should.
<I'm> sorry.
there is a balance to be found, I think, is what. But yeah. And so maybe it's no surprise that we go to great efforts to try to turn off that voice. So alcohol is something that people with social anxiety turn to. But just deeply, it can be exhausting to constantly be conscious, I think, and for some people more than others. So that desire to escape is something that many, many thinkers have talked about. It's at a core of like one kind of existentialism, which says that a lot of the activities that human beings engage in are activities in which we seek to escape the self. So going to a concert and just becoming part of the crowd is liberating because you're not you for a bit.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, a line from Eminem, lose yourself.
Right.
Which is the power of music, the power of crowds, sometimes the power of sex, of exercise, of sports, of engaged activities, which is, you know, among other things, you talk before about different forms of consciousness, and one form of consciousness is the consciousness of yourself. And just like we might get sick of a person in our life and need a break from them, we often need a break from ourselves.
That's right.
And that's an extremely, it is such an interesting human pursuit, which is we've been blessed through evolution to have this cognitive power that perhaps no other creature fully has. And then this power turns out to be an awful pain in the ass, and we try to get around it.
Yeah, there's a depressing way to end our discussion of consciousness, which is that it is, it can be the source of such suffering.
Well, the line is a cliche by now, but it's a blessing and a curse.